the Anarchist Book Club with Danny Evans and me, Jim Yeoman. In this episode, we're delighted to be joined by our long-term friend and comrade, Jessica Thorne, who has recently completed a PhD at Royal Holloway, University of London, which examines oppositional movements in prison and exile during the years of the Franco dictatorship in Spain. For this episode, we also read Jess's recent article published in European History Quarterly, which takes up some of the themes of her thesis. And all in all, it was a really fun, engaging and wide-ranging chat. So I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Jess. Thanks for being on the podcast. It's really lovely to have you here. Just to let listeners know, you know, me and Danny have known Jess for quite a long time. We've talked about one another's work all together, so it's a really nice opportunity for us to chat about Jess's work, thesis, which was completed last year.
Very late last year, so it's still pretty fresh, which is good.
Yeah, lovely. And the article which Jess had published in the European History Quarterly. Things are going to inform our discussion, thinking broadly, you know, around the themes of anarchism in Spain, sort of post-Civil War, thinking about the communities and politics that were kind of developed in prisons and between prisons and beyond. And that's kind of where we'll start the conversation today. So thinking about the CMT in the years after the Civil War, I mean, this really, I found really astute point that it was in the prisons of Spain that this was the place where the reality of defeat in the Civil War became really clear, that the workplace was no longer the site for organization in the movement. And you make this really insightful point in the article about the transnationalism, which kind of came up at this time, sort of in the 50s and early 60s, about this becoming a substitute for, rather than a complement to, the workplace organization that had been the kind of bread and butter of the CNT in the years kind of leading up to the Civil War. So, I mean, I thought this really rang quite a lot of bells with my own work around the movement in the turn of the century, you know, in moments of kind of repression, that, you know, the movement looked to things like international solidarity and direct actions when it couldn't really organize in that kind of mass mobilization in the workplace way. We could start by thinking about that as how, you know, those kind of responses from within the prisons, is that it often it's kind of lauded, these transnational moments and the reaching out. But if you could talk a bit more about how that can also be revealing of a weakness in the movement as well.
I mean, I remember discussing this, well, actually my PhD supervisor at the time, and I didn't think that point was particularly controversial, but she, you know, comes from a background, she's, you know, looks at histories of anarchism as well, and has done a lot of stuff on transnational studies. And she said the same point as you, Jim, that usually, like, you know, internationalism, transnationalism, we see it as like an expansion of movements, which can surely only be a positive thing. And I'm not trying to say that, like, the transnationalism, like, it was a kind of, you know, it was a mistake in terms of strategy or anything like that, not at all. I'm just, the point of that I made in that article was to just explain why, you know, the movement became less and better than the workplace and more scattered, and to follow those anarchist protagonists in the CNT through their journeys in exile and in prison, because that's where the vast majority of them went. The CNT did continue to exist in some form throughout the dictatorship within Spain, but it really kind of retreated into sort of kinship networks, friendship networks. You know, lots of the correspondence that I looked at when I was researching for this, but also, you know, more broadly for the thesis, you find that lots of meetings would take place just in people's homes, and they'd have to meet on alternate days of the week to avoid sort of suspicion and stuff like that. So it became very difficult to do politics in Spain in the 50s and 60s, going into the 70s. You know, doing politics outside of Spain, in exile, but also, and I also look at prison as a space sort of in a way that's outside of, like, the image of Spain, you know, that is presented by Francoism anyway. And Franco talks about its prisoners as you know, being like the anti-Spain. So I see them as both as kind of these outside spaces. I mean, we can see transnationalism as a practical response to sort of the context after the Civil War, where there's really severe levels of repression on the entire labour movement in Spain. You know, lots of scholars have written much more eloquently on this than me. You have mass executions, mass imprisonment. I mean, at one point immediately after the war, you're talking sort of early 40s, if you tally up all of those that are in prison, not just in like, you know, static prisons, but in labour battalions in sort of makeshift concentration camps, the figure tallies up to like close to 1 million, which is huge, absolutely huge. So this completely destroys the entire labour movement, and the CNT, of course, was a major, major component of that. You know, the most dominant tendency, if you're to look at it in terms of membership figures, the most dominant tendency. So transnationalism becomes a sort of practical response, and it's born out of a necessity for mutual aid. But there's also, obviously, I know that there's this kind of other side to it, which is that, you know, that there's an ideal of internationalism as well. And that goes right back to sort of the formation of, you know, the International Workers Association, the First International. It's got a much, much longer history. So that like kind of aspiration is always there, and it always informs anarchist politics and politics within the CNT, within sort of varying degrees, depending on what context we're looking at. But there's certain moments when, you know, there's a recognition that we need to sort of combine national and international struggle. And that recognition is reached during the 60s. But there's this such a huge disconnect between the kind of sequences of revolt that are associated with, you know, the anti-colonial struggles, you know, emerging around Vietnam, in Algeria, and then the revolutionary politics within Spain. There seems to be quite a severe disconnect in bringing those two things together, particularly, at least for the CNT, when it comes to workplace organising. And that's because in this context, particularly the 1950s, things start to thaw a little bit in the 1960s, but there is a kind of mass depoliticization of the general population within this climate of fear and very, very intense hot repression. So doing politics becomes difficult. It has to be done in a way, to some extent, outside of Spain.
That's a really insightful point. It's interesting that you said that it didn't kind of feel that sort of groundbreaking to make this observation, you know, until someone else pointed out to you, but it really struck me as well. So it's interesting that you know, because I'm used to, again, transnationalism and you know, myself and Danny have been thinking about this in terms of how is Spain and the Spanish movement been, you know, situated amongst kind of transnational studies and where it does and doesn't. And sometimes this makes me think about that, why often the Spanish movement isn't included in many of these transnational accounts. And it could be the reverse, really, of your observation that it was very strong. It did have a workplace presence. And so maybe it's kind of visibility on it, where the need to kind of reach out transnationally was perhaps less at some points.
There's a point worth making as well, that like this is a period of revolutionary internationalism, but depending on what sort of political camp you fall into, internationalism looks very different. And the CNT and like the anarchist opposition in Spain were kind of at a disadvantage in the sense that they weren't the Communist Party, they weren't attached to something like the Soviet Union, where there's all this political and economic capital and cultural capital to sort of like feed. Obviously at a time when, you know, Soviet Union's being is also in a sort of state of war. Anarchists kind of fall outside of that. They're kind of completely ostracized. They don't have that sort of institutional support that, you know, you saw with the international brigades and those sort of more sort of institutionalized parts of the labor movement in Europe. They kind of sit outside of that. So they have to kind of, that you have the International Workers Association and that kind of continues as an institution, but it's quite stagnant, I've found. I mean, I've looked at Congress reports of the International Workers Association all through sort of the 50s and 60s, and it's just quite stagnant. And it's clear that this is a movement that is like internationally, there's variations, but like that is kind of in a period of crisis and is struggling to sort of resonate with some of those newer social movements that are appearing at the time.
Yeah, is it the case as well that for the CNT exiles in particular, like that the potentials of that transnational were truncated by the threat of deportation as well. So I know that like some CNT exiles did get involved in things like 68 in France and stuff, but the extent to which they could like make any kind of like lasting formal links with new social movements that were emerging in those countries was somewhat limited by that, the dreadful threat of like deportation back to Spain.
I mean, that you're totally right. And the repression in France in particular on the anarchist movement was really, really severe. There were constant police raids on CNT exile offices in Paris and elsewhere. There were deportations like were made. And there was one stage in particular where, this is something I actually picked up in Stuart Christie's memoir, where he was sort of suggesting there was a sort of exchange almost of prisoners between France and Spain. Spain in the 50s and 60s became refuge to a lot of far-right elements in the French army that were involved in Algeria. Spain became a sort of refuge for them and other sort of war criminals that escaped from the 1940s. And then in exchange for, you know, Spanish anarchists or Republican prisoners that still posed or were deemed to still pose a threat to the regime back in Spain. So there's that interesting geopolitical aspect of it as well. It was almost impossible for the CNT to re-establish itself as a trade union in the context of the Cold War, at the height of, you know, sort of global McCarthyism, you know, especially a trade union that was committed to sort of permanent revolution and directly hostile to the state. So that was something that was basically avoided. I don't think had the resource to do it, to be honest. At that stage, the focus was on helping those that were left back in Spain, because those were the links that they had. You could see the beginnings of sort of some of the like economic migrants coming from Spain over to France in the 50s, 60s and such of work. And there is this generational and cultural disconnect between the two groups. They try and get them involved in the life of the CNT because, you know, those are the sort of people that perhaps they could have been this new sort of social base sort of for the CNT outside of Spain. But there was just too much of a lack of recognition between both social groups. Like there's quite funny letters with like old veteran CNT members complaining about the new kids on the block and they just want to talk about football and they're not interested in politics. I think it's important when we think about sort of why did anarchist internationalism take the shape that it did? How did it emerge? Because France was the main sort of hub. Spanish anarchist revolutionary.
It's kind of quite neatly sort of moved into the next question we're going to think about, which is another big theme that to come out of your article, was this kind of generational analysis and thinking about the shifts of the post-Civil War CNT in terms of generations. And it's almost as if kind of those weaknesses that we've been talking about, or the anarchist movement's situation in the Cold War is kind of not really having a home or not aligning very neatly in that. And it's almost as if that's part of its appeal then when we get to the mid 60s, let's say, to a new generation, particularly internationally on the left, or the new left as it's called, and how a movement that's often seen as kind of making a break or trying to make a break with the old left traditions, finding in the history of Spanish anarchism something to look to as an example and as a model to kind of bring up. I wondered why you felt that the revolution in Spain of 1936 held that resonance. One idea that I wondered on is that, is it the case that almost because of the scale of defeat, which you've mentioned, and because of the kind of breaking apart of the movement, it's scattering, its existence in exile or prison, in a sense, like because it's no longer present on an international scale, at least, it becomes a fixed, usable history that can be kind of looked to as something that hasn't been sort of tainted so much in the 50s and 60s. But that was just one idea, and I wondered if you had any other thoughts on that.
I think that's an interesting point. Obviously, at this point, on the sort of extra parliamentary left more generally in Europe, there is this kind of like searching around at this stage, because obviously a lot happens in the 50s in terms of the political recomposition of the left. So, you know, you have events like, you know, the heightening of the war in Algeria, the Hungarian revolution, and it's sort of brutal put down by the Soviet regime. And then also the kind of the cracks emerging within sort of social democracy more broadly, how sort of social democratic governments remain sort of complicit in upholding colonial enterprises. So there's a kind of mass disillusionment with everything that is like available to them at that point. I think in times of defeat, when this happens, when you kind of, you know, you struggle to sort of resonate with anything, you kind of, you can't help but go backwards. And I think, you know, the example of 1936 and the revolution in Spain, it was an example of a revolution which was kind of critical of the state. And, you know, by the time of the 1950s, this is a time when many people are beginning to ask questions about sort of the legitimacy of the state, you know, whether, you know, revolutionary groups need to seize the state, and what does it mean to seize the state, and would that fundamentally transform things? And obviously all of these questions came to surface in the revolution in Spain in 36. And, you know, they go back further as well to the Paris Commune. It's not just Spain, but it's an immediate example. And it's, I know it's sort of like you're talking 30 years ago, but many of those, like those Spanish exiles and veterans are sort of present in and around these new left spaces. So in France, if you look at where a lot of Spanish exiles sort of end up, they're kind of living side by side by sort of like migrant populations and also student populations. So they're coming across, you know, new emerging social movements around sort of anti-colonialism, broader social movements sort of around feminism, and they're kind of exposed to not new ideas, because many of these sort of anarchist veterans have come in contact with these things before, but it's certainly like it challenges their sort of understanding of the world and their place within it, I would say. And then in places like Britain, France and Britain are sort of the two areas where like I really focus on. A lot of Spanish anarchists in London ended up in Notting Hill, which again, it's a migrant population, a large black population. Notting Hill has like a very strong neo-Nazi group that's active at the time. You know, they come out of Spain and then they're kind of back into the maelstrom of politics again, where they're living. You know, they're looking at what happened in the Spanish Revolution and then extrapolating that onto some of the ideas that, you know, they see emerging with the new left. It's actually, they're living side by side with these people and they're physically encountering these movements. So it's not just this like abstract internationalism. It is located in actual real world struggle.
Yeah, I wonder if any of them came across, you know, Michael Moorcock was, you know, the science fiction writer was, I'm pretty sure he's like from the Ladbroke Grove, Notting Hill, Gate area. You know, he identified himself as an anarchist, or he like still calls himself an anarchist, I think. He's talked in interviews about like being an undercover anti-fascist, joining a Nazi group, and like going along to these meetings in this person's house. The way I remember it is like, he says it was basically like The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton, like the majority of the people in this like neo-Nazi group were like him, you know, were like undercover lefties. It is interesting, like this point about like 1936 as a reference for people in that period of flux, because like, as you mentioned in the article, like Guy Debord referenced it, you know, as a high point, you know, the CNT is like the greatest proletarian organization or something. You've got like the Solidarity group, which emerged in the 60s, you know, around like Maurice Brinton and stuff that like talked about Spain. But then like other people associated with the new left, you know, especially in England, like E.B. Thompson and things, you know, they never mentioned like the Spanish Revolution. You know, they didn't want to think about the Spanish Civil War as anything other than, you know, the good old anti-fascist cause.
I think in some ways, like with most things, like the English variant of the New Left was the most conservative. I feel like that with most sort of like iterations of movements, to be honest. In the article as well, I use was reading a lot of work by Karl Mannheim at the time, who's a sociologist, has done a lot of work on the idea of generations, because it was something as a concept I was always very sceptical of, actually, like just in terms of where I was in political movements. And whenever I saw sort of scholarly work on sort of generations, I just found it really, like a really shallow kind of analysis. And I would always encounter it around stuff like the 1960s, where you see like youth counterculture and stuff like that. And I just never found it particularly compelling. But what I try to do is kind of combine Mannheim's sort of generational analysis with like a class analysis as well. Because how I sort of frame those generational breaks is it's not to do with how old people are, or like that, you know, sort of the chronology of time more broadly. It's to do with the pace of change and how history moves, and sometimes it moves very fast, or it feels like it's moving very fast, and other times it feels like it's kind of stagnant. In Spain and in broader Western Europe, it's not just Spain, that period from sort of the end of the Second World War up to the 70s, just the pace of change is like incredible. In Spain, you have 20% after the Civil War, 20% of the population move residents. Like, that's just such a huge population movement for a country. And that sudden movement from, I don't know, somewhere like a rural area of Spain into Barcelona or Madrid or wherever, you're going to come into contact with some very like new and different experiences. Now, previously, when you look at sort of particularly the Spanish anarchist movement, and you look at this like question of like intergenerational links within the anarchist movement more broadly, you know, at times where there's high peak class consciousness, like within sort of the general working population, that movement from the countryside to the city was actually a kind of galvanizing force for the CNC, and became the basis for its like organization as a trade union. The problem is that like the city, okay, it's in the context of Francoism, it's perhaps a little less of a repressive atmosphere than it is in the countryside, where you're kind of ruled by, you know, like a very close nexus of like the local priest and your landlord, and it's very suffocating, and there's no kind of anonymity. Everyone knows who everyone is. That experience of this, it's less repressive, but it's still suffocating. Police presence is still very high. And it continues to be hard to do politics. So those migrants from the sort of 40s and 50s that are arriving to the city, they're not coming into contact with a labour movement that's on the rise. It's being kind of obliterated, and there's kind of fragments of it about. Like, they'll go into some workplaces, or they'll join the local factory, and there might be one older guy there who everyone tells him to avoid because he's trouble, you know? Like, but it's like that, it's whisper networks, and it's not... In Franco Spain, there's no like big, there's no, the public sphere has been completely narrowed, basically. And doing trade unionism outside of the remits that are permitted by the state is impossible, totally impossible. When I'm using the concept of generation, I try and use it in a way that's actually historicized, rather than, well, these people just got really old and lost touch with their like younger comrades, which obviously is not like useful or helpful. And what that article looks at is actually some of the connections between those, you know, figures like Stuart Crissey, who went over to Spain in 1964 to aid an assassination attempt on Franco, was 18. And what did he, the people that he was helping were sort of 30 years his senior, but their experiences in terms of like class and background were very like kind of similar. You know, Stuart came from a mining town in Glasgow, very working class background. And of course there were differences, there were huge like sort of social and cultural differences, but both of those groups were kind of experienced this period of flux at the same time. And sometimes what happened, Mannheim has this point, if change happens too quickly, then what can happen is that the younger group will latch on to sort of older reference to kind of like feel grounded in something, because they can't really understand sort of what's going on around them, or they don't have the kind of analytical framework. It isn't like available to them, so they have to go back to sort of foundational texts or events like 36 in Spain.
So perhaps you could expand a bit more on the story of Stuart Christian, since it's so central to this particular article. So he's condemned to death, that sentence then commuted, and he spends a long time in prison. So, but you could expand on like how he develops like these relationships with older anarchists and the significance of that for his later activity.
I'm sure for many of your listeners, they would all probably have heard of Stuart, but he becomes a really important figure within the Spanish anarchist movement and the British anarchist movement. He kind of like, you know, straddles across both movements. His political formation is really interesting. It perfectly distills my thesis, really, in terms of why were certain segments of the New Left looking towards anarchist veterans as a kind of, for tactics and strategy and a, you know, framework to understand the world. And he first got involved in politics through sort of anti-nuclear stuff in the 50s. By all accounts, if you were like young and in Scotland in the 50s, you were most likely in the CND. It was huge, like a massive, massive movement. Through that activism, sort of, you know, your bog standard civil disobedience, came in contact with a more, slightly more radical group that were in favour of sort of breaking into US spaces, more sort of direct action stuff. This group called the Committee of 100, which some participants in that group were then later involved in the trial of the Angry Brigade, the British sort of urban guerrilla group, compared to groups like the Red Army faction, but very, very distinct and quite unique in a way. He then gets involved in sort of that direct action side of the anti-war and anti-nuclear movement. And it's there that he comes into contact with lots of Spanish anarchists, because they're contrary to, I read this, I think it was like, it was an article in some sort of like New Left Birkbeck magazine in the 70s that Hobsbawm wrote. He talks about encountering Spanish anarchists in this cafe in Paris in the 50s. And he was like, oh, they're like, you know, bohemians of a bygone era. These sort of like tragic figures have no sort of place within the world as it presently stands, as if they're kind of insular and not really, you know, like engaging with the world. And I found like quite the opposite. Like, they were frequently going on anti-war demonstrations, were involved in the CND, and participating in sort of anti-colonial movements as well. And it's because all of those things spoke directly to the, you know, position of where the Spanish working class, what the Spanish working class was in. It directly affected them as well. I'm digressing there, back to Stuart. So he encounters some Spanish anarchists, kind of galvanized by the direct action stuff that he got involved in around the Committee of 100. Is already familiar with the case of what's been happening in Spain, like where he grew up in this mining town. I think there were three international brigaders that went over and fought, that became these sort of like folk heroes within the town. So he kind of grew up with this like inherited memory of what had happened in Spain, and ended up traveling there, assisted by anarchist exiles in France with the intention of assassinating Franco. He wasn't actually, you know, he was delivering the goods, as it were. He wasn't firing the trigger, but it failed. And it was quite clear that there was an informer. Well, we know there were many informers within the exile CNT group in France. And he was followed and arrested, and then subsequently imprisoned for initially 20 years. He only served three just because of diplomatic pressure. Didn't look great when, you know, the Spanish state was trying to appeal to British tourists to come on holiday when they had like an 18-year-old Brit in one of their prisons. That sort of leniency wasn't granted to Spanish anarchists, let's put it that way. I think Stuart's co-defendant was one of the longest serving prisoners in Spain, actually. He then spends some time, initially he goes to Carabanchel, which is his prison in the suburbs of Madrid. It's kind of like vaunted by the regime during its reconstruction period as kind of like the like prison par excellence. It's like where like all the latest modern criminological thought, which is not very modern in some ways. You know, there's lots of like eugenicist, dodgy, very dodgy and heinous sort of stuff going on there. And he's placed there. It's a huge prison. It was never finished. It kind of remained partially unfinished for the entire time it existed. And that's when he gets, you know, he has first proper contact with the movement that, you know, he's been given this mythology of what the movement in Spain is like. And he goes into prison and realizes that he's in the minority. You know, the majority of political prisoners in that prison are in or around the Communist Party. And then there's also an increasing number of non-political prisoners who, you know, come from sort of like working class backgrounds who've been forced into sort of like petty crime and, you know, serving very long prison sentences as a result. So it's a kind of a wake-up call for him. The anarchists that he does encounter are very significant sort of figures within the movement. So there's one particular Spanish anarchist called Luis Andrés Erdo, and he ends up meeting Stuart a bit later, sort of the mid-60s. They are very quickly split up from each other because I basically found in some of Stuart's letters that he wrote at that prison that they were planning an escape together, and they caught wind of it, so they were split up. It's really interesting, like if you read Christie's biographies, he calls Carabanchel, you see Spain through this sort of like sociological panorama in prison, like it becomes this like a lens through which to see what's actually going on in society in Spain, like the Spain that you don't see. He gets to see what, you know, the opposition really looks like and what groups really seem to have an influence. And obviously you can't just go by prisoner numbers, but it is pretty indicative if like all political opposition is criminalised, trade union activity is criminalised. You know, if the majority of those people in that prison are with a particular political party, it suggests that their influence outside is considerable. And at this stage, you can see that the anarchist movement is really declining. And there's other internationals that come into the prison at that time as well from elsewhere in Europe. And they come to the prison sort of around the New Left, and they leave, many of them leave prison as members of the Communist Party. That's how influential the party is within the prison. I mean, you have certain prisons like Burgos, you know, referred to as just the university by the Communist Party, because it's just like a massive, massive hub of Communist Party prisons. And you don't have, in the 50s, there's some prisons that have like very large amounts of anarchist prisoners, but there's not like an anarchist prison. Do you know what I mean? They're a lot more sporadic and split and all over the place. And it's because it's reflecting the fact that they're also weak on the outside.
So did the party approach Christie then, do you know?
He had encounters with the party in prison. I mean, and it's hard to verify this stuff, right? Because it's literally, it's Christie's account. He petitioned himself sort of to be put in with the political prisoners that were mostly Communist Party in this particular gallery where they all were. And he thinks that it was the Communist Party prisoners who kind of quite successfully organised that wing that were like, no, we don't want that sort, because we're prisoners of conscience. We're not engaged in direct violence. If we have someone that's like associated with terrorism, essentially, then that's going to, you know, it's going to tarnish us, as it were. How to verify that, I don't know. I have looked at some of the letters that were smuggled out of prison by Communist Party activists, and it does seem that, you know, in terms of strategy and tactics, that the leadership of the Communist Party was kind of like suggesting to those in prison. They did disagree with a lot of the more sort of militant tactics like hunger strikes. I came across one particular letter, I think, that was smuggled out of Burgos, saying that like, there's a debate in the Communist Party about whether like a hunger strike is this like bourgeois individualistic protest sort of thing, which is really interesting to me, because I think a lot of the struggles that have been written about in those prisons of Communist Party prisoners, you don't see those side of the debates that were going on and those divisions between the leadership and the rank and file. Yeah, it's something I'd like to look, dig a bit deeper on some of that stuff because I think it'd be really interesting.
You have several lines which kind of stuck with me there about, you know, prisons as a living entity and a laboratory, a transmission belt for ideas and debates. Prison and exile became islands of anarchy from which new kinds of imaginary communities were born. It's more in this time when people like Christie became incarcerated and places like Carabanchel that this kind of living entity could take form. To me, it would be really interesting to hear a bit more about the almost a reversal of the image I think that many people have of prison as a kind of static and sealed off and isolated place, and you know, where things stagnate, which is the word that you use, and thinking about it as something generative and fluid. I mean, did Christie see it as a place where ideas could form and take shape, and thinking beyond Christie, thinking about the movement as a whole, you know, do you think there was that aspect of prison, I think, which is perhaps often overlooked?
Yeah, I think so. The whole point of prison itself is to sort of deprive people of agency, right? Completely. You're set in terms of your eating times when you can go out for your like hours of exercise a day, sometimes not even that. It's very regimented. And the whole purpose of that is to deprive those that, you know, inhabit the prison of agency. You know, they are prisons. It's incredibly hard space to kind of pursue politics and to continue to do politics. For anarchists particularly, it is done really through friendship. And that's something that prison does foster, even, you know, in these like very sort of adverse circumstances. It does foster very intense friendships that, you know, many of these prisoners maintain long after they leave. And I think in some ways, in those like very repressive circumstances, those sort of friendships can be more generative of sort of political struggle and ideas. It looks very different to sort of, if you look at groups like the Communist Party, where it's a lot more structured through the machinery of the party. And friendship obviously plays a role there too. It does in every political, social, human formation, I think. That's just like a natural part of how we operate. But the prison kind of brings people together in a regimented way, in a way that they're not able to do on the street or in their like local coffee shop. Like all those public spaces that we associate with the trade union movement, like the trade union hall, or like, you know, some of those like anarchist libraries that emerged sort of pre-Civil War, all those spaces are kind of not available to them. Prison, like some people end up building up their own sort of clandestine libraries and stuff like that. So there is, even in such dark circumstances, there is ways of kind of building a political culture. Often that political culture that we see in the prison among anarchists is built out of sort of fragments of the past. Memory plays an important role, which means that, you know, when they encounter some of the common prisoners, which historically, you know, if you look at anarchist critiques of the prison in sort of the 30s and sort of some of their writings on crime, you know, they see, you know, prisoners as that have, you know, been in prison for sort of like petty crime or theft, which is in this period, the overwhelming majority, as like social prisoners, as like victims of the class system, that they need to unionize or, you know, bring within the CNT as part of this, you know, under this banner of the dispossessed, you know, everyone that is dispossessed needs to be brought under this revolutionary banner. Now, unfortunately, like under Francoism, what we see between these two groups is like this mutual suspicion of one another, because common prisoners associate political prisoners with trouble and longer sentences. And this is the power of Francoism to kind of like really like demonize and stigmatize those that are associated with the opposition, or like, you know, sort of that the politics before Francoism. And then there's also suspicion on the part of some of the anarchist prisoners who, because hunger and poverty is so rife in large parts of Spain, and that's fundamentally what is driving many of these common prisoners into the jails, because they haven't been sort of like socialized within, you know, some of those cultural institutions of the CNT that emerged in the 20s, 30s, earlier during your period that you looked at, Jim, they see them as like likely to be bought off and become informers. They don't trust them. And that does limit activity in the prison. There are instances where you see like riots and it kind of just involves almost every prisoner. It's a bit of a free-for-all. But on the whole, these groups tend to keep themselves to themselves. And that kind of you know, experience of union activity isn't brought into the prison, I would say. You know, it is among themselves, and that it's a way for the anarchist movement to maintain itself and maintain continuity, but I wouldn't say it expands its influence sort of in the prison. There's certain alliances that are made, like very interesting ones as well, with post 67 in Spain, there's a big clampdown on the labour movement, in particular these groups called the Workers' Commissions, which kind of very tied closely together with the Communist Party. By the late 60s, it's pretty much the Communist Party that is in charge of the Workers' Commissions. They get heavily repressed. That strategy that the Communist Party used, which was kind of like a strategy of entryism. So if your listeners who don't know, Francoism had, you could be in a trade union, but it was one trade union and it was basically the employer's trade union. It's kind of like Mussolini's sort of syndicalism, this kind of classic version of classic fascist version of syndicalism. The Communist Party had this strategy to basically gather people together in these clandestine assemblies called workers' commissions and elect their own shop stewards within the kind of state structure to sort of subvert it. And it is quite successful for the first part of the 60s. And then they start to arrest all of its leaders. And because it's such a top-down, it's got such a top-down centralized structure, it kind of falls apart very quickly and the Communist Party splinters in all directions. And then, you know, and this is, it's talking 67, 68, so the height of the New Left, the height of that insurgency that you see in France, the Prague Spring, other parts of the world as well. That's when you see this return again to the anarchist, you know, the anarchist movement 36 in Spain. And we do see this alliance that emerges in some of the prisons between anarchist prisoners and those that belong to ETA. And it's mainly because both groups are kind of like obviously not averse to using sort of direct action as a method. Very different forms of direct action, obviously. You know, there's a big difference between, you know, sort of very targeted assassination and then sort of what the later incarnations of ETA were doing. But at the time, prison was quite good at flattening some political distinctions. And I've always found it I found it interesting that, you know, anarchists are able to kind of align themselves with ETA at the time, considering, you know, the critique of sort of like national liberation and stuff like that. But I think in the, again, in the context of defeat, and particularly in the context of prison, you need allies to sort of change the culture of the prison and make it more sort of livable.
I mean, well, you mentioned how like some of the anarchist prisoners formed like lasting friendships. In Stuart Christie's case, you also have like this organizational legacy in the Cruz Negra Internacional, or the Anarchist Black Cross. So do you want to like just explain what that was, how it came about, and what its main activity was?
It has a longer history, actually. It doesn't just emerge with Stuart Christie. I'm really like dredging my brain now, but I think it emerges during, in the wake of the Russian Revolution, am I right? Or during the Russian Civil War?
I thought it was in the Tsarism.
Oh, was it under Tsar? Maybe earlier. Maybe, yeah. It comes out of Russia anyway, I know. I remember that. I'm not quite sure of the history subsequent to that up until the 60s. I don't know if it lies dormant or what. It seems to be essentially, Stuart Christie revives it with Albert Meltzer, who was another person very senior to Stuart, part of that 36 generation, really. I mean, maybe a little marginally too young.
Yeah, he wrote for war commentary during the war and stuff like that.
they revived the Anarchist Black Cross and set up as sort of a mutual aid group, but one that also, you know, it doesn't want to just be sort of an ambulance going around picking up casualties from sort of class struggle. Like, it also wants to supply the class struggle with, you know, funds and other things. I think there's, in one of like the first issues of the Anarchist Black Cross, it's like a bulletin that they send out, and it's like, we need duplicators, typewriters, and guns. It's just like, it really like just zooms off at the end there. But I think they saw themselves as sort of, as both a sort of a mutual aid network for prisoners. But initially the focus was on Spain, because anarchist prisoners in Spain weren't really getting any international support outside of their own internal networks. Things like Amnesty International wouldn't touch them because they didn't fit the profile of being a prisoner of conscience at all. Obviously the Communist Party, those sort of networks wouldn't touch them either. So there was a real necessity for something like this that could operate outside of Spain safely, although it was also subject to raids and there was a kind of international policing effort there as well. But it kind of expands quite rapidly. In 68, 69, there's chapters of the Anarchist Black Cross that emerge in West Germany. One of the founders of the chapter in West Germany is actually shot, killed during one of the like sequences of student mobilizations. And then there's in Italy, Giuseppe Pinelli kind of become immortalized. I imagine some of your listeners would have heard of that name. He was killed by police. Pose at the time fell out of a police station window. But he met Stuart at a congress in Italy the year prior, and had kind of set up a chapter of the Black Cross in Italy as well. So there, it became this kind of like international network, which would send out appeals in its bulletins for sort of prisoner support. It would have like a, you know, the prisoner addresses where people were, you could write to them. And in some ways, it was an affinity group. So like you have people like Stuart and Albert, and you had like the editorial group around the Anarchist Black Cross. And it kind of, it stayed like that. But I think in some ways, there was a broader periphery around it, more aligned with the new left, sort of younger elements of the new left. Because obviously at that time, it's not just like anarchists that are getting repressed. It's the entire global left, anti-war movements, civil rights movements. You've got stuff kicking off in Ireland and elsewhere. So it becomes really, really crucial. When some of those anarchist prisoners in Spain leave, quite a few of them like go over to London and set up their lives there because of the Anarchist Black Cross, and you know, they rebuild their life for themselves there. There's questions about, I don't think it will ever, we won't know until like sort of archives become available, whether, you know, the Anarchist Black Cross was directly providing weapons to certain direct action groups like the 1st of May group, which sort of emerged in the late 60s, which went on this sort of targeted kidnapping and bombing campaign targeted against certain figures of the Franco regime. But that hasn't been answered by anyone I've spoken to, and I understand why that would be the case. But yeah, it was just it, and it's still going. Obviously, you know, the Black Cross is still it's an institution that has lasted. And I think, you know, increasingly now, perhaps like that practice of writing letters to prisoners is kind of maybe in the last sort of 10 years gone out of favour a little bit, because just in terms of how the left in Britain has composed itself and how struggle has developed, how the state has responded to sort of protests. It's only sort of in the last 5 years, I think, where you've seen like such a huge crackdown by the state on things which were, you know, very simple civil rights stuff around Kill the Bill and stuff like that. So I think, you know, it's an interesting example to go back and look at, because I think it's like quite useful for where we're at now, and we're seeing, you know, increasing numbers of people that are encountering like prison or being arrested, and there's an increasing like criminalization of protest and trade union activity. I mean, that's sort of criminalization's been ongoing for 30 years, and it looks like it's not going to get conceivably better anytime soon.
Thanks for listening. You can keep in touch with the podcast via the email abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com and on Twitter @abcdannyandjim. You can subscribe to our newsletter at abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. And if you're interested in getting hold of one of our pamphlets, Victor Garcia's Jose Chena Torrent, A Contribution to a Necessary Biography, translated by Danny, you can find some details on how to do that in the notes to this show. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael de Nocio, Gente de Miña Terra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo, and the image in this episode is a picture of Carabanchel Prison, which we discussed in the show. Love and solidarity. Until next time.
Senhor Secretário de Estado, faz favor, tenha a palavra, não existe.